Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network. Good afternoon, Jim. Great to be back slightly sooner than expected from our last podcast. We've got a lot to talk about today because the events of the weekend have kind of taken over the global agenda. Since the beginning of this year, well, since the end of last year, really, you and I have been saying that 2024 will be dominated by geopolitics. And sadly, we was right. At least so far. It's only April, after all. Iran has attacked Israel with 300 missiles. The headlines are full of the news about that, how 99% of them were shot down, how the secret shadow war between Iran and Israel of the last number of years has broken out into the open. This was, of course, a response to the Israeli attack on the Syrian-based diplomatic mission, consulate-type building in Damascus of a few weeks ago, in which a number of Iranian Revolutionary Guard soldiers and other Iranians were killed. And the situation we're in right now is that I think when that news broke about the 300 missiles on their way, even then there was a hope because the Iranian intentions had been telegraphed for a good number of days that it wouldn't be the big one. But nevertheless, it was a test of the Israeli defensive systems, which those systems clearly have passed with flying colours, if you like. And as we're speaking, financial markets have reacted in a relatively restrained fashion. As I say, when the news first broke, I think many of us with a background in financial markets would have thought this is going to be awful. Financial markets are likely to crater on Monday. That's a technical term for falling. Oil prices are likely to soar, and none of those things have happened. Oil prices have actually fallen slightly, and equity and bond markets are, shall we say, stable. They're not doing anything in particular. So it's already, events have turned out not what we expected. One of the things that I often think about during times of great turbulence, news that is shocking, whether it's economic, financial, or political news in this case, is that the market's first reaction is often wrong. You'll find that within a few days it'll have gone the other way to how things are started, but we'll see if that rule of thumb holds this time. So I'm not suggesting for a second that I know where markets are going. But I do think from an economist's perspective, Jim, a lot depends on the oil price, as you and I have been saying for quite some time. But I also think that old-fashioned, cliched thing, sentiment, it isn't helped by any of this, not least because the risk is that the thing that we feared after October the 7th of last year has, in a very key way, started to happen, which is regional escalation. The Iranians have said they think that they're done, that provided Israel doesn't retaliate, this is over. But of course, that shadow war isn't over. The Iran's proxies throughout the region will continue their nefarious deeds. And there is the Israeli reaction, which we've yet to see. They have promised to react. The Americans have asked them not to. Regional war will only be averted if one or both of these actors don't retaliate. And somebody has to stop. By definition, if somebody doesn't stop, we're heading for a big war in the Middle East, or a bigger one than we've already got. The second, out of many points, we could talk about this all day, Jim, and I'm conscious already I've taken more time than I said I would, so I apologize, is that this success of the Israeli defensive system throws into very sharp relief the failure of the West to provide those exact same defensive systems to Ukraine. Because all of the stuff that was sent Israel's way is the stuff that is being sent every single day, or every single night, actually, by Russia against Ukrainian targets. And if we simply supplied them with the same kit and assistance that Israel has got, Ukraine wouldn't be losing on the battlefield as it is now. And I think that's an important point to stress. We've mentioned it before. Ukraine is losing territory every day. It's not huge, but in the nature of war, what can be incremental gains by your enemy can all of a sudden be very, very large if your defenses collapse all of a sudden. So I think it puts into very sharp relief the fact that we are not providing Ukraine with the defenses that it needs, but we are supplying Israel with the defensive systems that it needs. That's a value judgment, isn't it, Jim?
Yeah, it is. No, absolutely, Chris. I 100% agree. Saturday night did prove what effective support for Ukraine would help achieve, but that support just isn't forthcoming at the moment. I'm really kind of puzzled by all of this, because there is a narrative out there that nobody wants outright war in the Middle East. Iran doesn't, Israel doesn't, or any of the other actors down there don't. That's the sort of common perception. And yet, what the hell did Israel expect? You know, as you say, they launched an attack on the Iranian diplomatic compound in Damascus in Syria at the beginning of April. It was inevitable that the Iranians would respond to that. And what we saw on Saturday night, as you say, was the response. It was huge provocation for Israel. It's the first time that Iran has attacked Israel from its own territory. So it does mark a pretty significant escalation in the relationship between the two countries. But what is going on here, Chris, in the sense that, as I say, the narrative is that nobody wants outright war, but yet Israel attacks that compound in Damascus. And as I say, what the hell did Israel expect but a response from Iran? That response has now come. And I guess one thing that Netanyahu has actually achieved in the last 48 hours is basically bringing a lot of Western support behind Israel again, because obviously over the last few weeks, a few months actually, he had been coming under increasing pressure from the West to back off in Gaza and, you know, call a ceasefire and all the rest. So from a position where he was certainly losing Western support because of his decision to attack the Iranian compound in Damascus and the inevitable Iranian response to that, he's now in a situation where the West has rolled in behind Israel once again.
And we're not talking about Gaza nearly as much as we were.
Exactly. Yeah, the whole focus is gone.
And so the achievement of the Iranians is that we're now focused on regional conflagration and the risks of, rather than what's actually going on in Gaza. We should be talking about both, of course, but inevitably the 24-hour news cycle can only ever focus on one thing at a time. And so I think that they may have made some strategic errors, the Iranians here. Maybe there's strategic errors on all sides. What's really interesting to me is that there are lots of publications talking about the relative size and quality of the Israeli and Iranian armed forces. And it's striking how Iran has a lot more airplanes, tanks, and ships, but they're all Soviet era. This is the extraordinary thing. They've actually got
F4s and F5s, which I think were American planes back in the 1960s, from when Iran was actually an ally of the United States and the United States supplied Iran with arms. Such is the way of the world and how things change. A lot of its tanks, if not all of its tanks, are supplied by the Soviet Union back in the day. And so although it's got a much bigger conventional military than Israel's, the quality of Israel's tanks and aircraft are much better than Israel. So there's a sense in which people might think that in a conventional war between Iran and Israel, Israel might actually win because of the quality of its kit as opposed to quantity. Who knows? I'm not a military strategist. Of course, it raises the nuclear question. Israel does have nuclear weapons, we think. We don't think Iran has. If it does, it must have only recently acquired them, but it certainly is close to acquiring them. So this still has the capacity to be extremely, extremely dangerous. The oil price, Jim, from any, we could talk about all the different aspects about this. Frankly, I don't feel qualified to assess the military likelihood or what the outcome of an actual war between Israel and Iran would be. I do know that it would be bad for all of us. I think that it would make, you know, we would be rerunning the global financial crisis conditions that we saw 15 years ago, or the economic consequences of the pandemic. It would be a different kind of problem that the world faces, but it would be certainly of that order of magnitude, if not worse. Because, you know, if Iran and Israel go to war with each other, will the United States be dragged in? I think at the moment, the people in Israel that do want war with Israel, with Iran, and there are some, by no means the majority, but I do think there are some people who think that, they think that they do have a blank check. They're completely backstopped by the United States, and the United States couldn't help but get involved. All these different things, these ifs, buts, and maybes. If there was an outright war, it would be dreadful economically and financially. And the initial impact would always be felt. The thing to watch, as we keep saying, is the oil price. So it is remarkable that it's gone down today. On, Jim.
Chris, before we go on to the market and economic implications, what's going on, you said you're not qualified to, you know, talk about this in the war in a real sense. But yet, on Sunday night, you send me a WhatsApp saying that, Jim, do you think we should have a podcast tomorrow, given that we're on the brink of World War III? You wrote an excellent piece on your weekly war diary over the weekend where, and you added an addendum to take account of what happened on Saturday night. But, you know, you were talking about the reaction of North Korea to what's going on at the moment, the reaction of the Chinese to what's going on at the moment. You tied it into the whole Western failure to support Ukraine in an appropriate way at the moment. You paint an incredibly bleak picture of the global geopolitical backdrop at the moment. So how serious were you about the brink of World War III on Sunday night?
Very serious, actually, Jim. I, as I say, would not forecast it. I wouldn't claim to have the expertise to forecast it. But I do note that people who seem to know what they're talking about, either because they're in or connected to the intelligence community, they might be historians that have studied these sorts of patterns for in a much deeper way than I have. There are a number of people whom I respect, don't necessarily agree completely with, but just I know that the articles that, essentially saying this is beginning to look a lot like the 1930s, are being written, in that there were all sorts of little bombs geopolitically going off around the world during the 1930s, that ultimately, when we look back using our rearview mirror, we can see we're all connected to each other. And people are describing the various little geopolitical bombs, some very large ones, going off at the moment in similar terms, and asking the question that at the end of the day is all, nobody is saying this is the start of World War III. I do note, however, that Donald Tusk, the Prime Minister of Poland, has described the present situation before this weekend, actually, as a pre-war situation. He's used that term. I'm not quite sure what it means, but it certainly conveys the idea that we are closer to an outright war than we were. And when I talk about historians, there's one historian that sometimes I don't respect very much at all in the United States, Niall Ferguson, but he is certainly saying this is the 1930s being repeated. There's a guy at Johns Hopkins called Hal Brands who's made similar comments and written in similar fashion, saying this is beginning to feel a lot like the 1930s. And Max Hastings, who is an eminent British historian, military historian here in the UK, has described the way in which we are unprepared for what is happening next. Max Hastings thinks, and this is possibly the one historian that I agree with the most, because what he describes, I think, has already started, which is that he doesn't think that whatever's coming is going to be, for example, Britain getting invaded or Europe being, or Western Europe being invaded by Russia's tanks, but it will be a form of hybrid warfare. And by that, that's, you know, proxies in the way that Iran uses proxies to attack Israel up until this weekend, so that there couldn't be attribution or direct line connecting you with the attacks. The cutting of undersea telecommunications links, internet cables going down, attacks on energy infrastructure, both actual blowing up of pipelines anonymously and also cyber attacks on utilities, energy infrastructure, and any infrastructure actually that is vulnerable to cyber attacks, which these days is all infrastructure. And all of these things are already happening to a greater or less extent around the world, Jim. All of those things, those aren't forecasts. And Putin especially is an expert at these sorts of things. And the final thing that you can expect, which is already happening big time, is disinformation. And I gave an example in the piece that you nicely spoke about there. Thank you for that plug. About an expose by the big Swedish media corporation, SVT, into Russian disinformation campaigners around the world. And it gives lots of different examples. I won't go through them here. If you want to see what that was about, just read my piece. The disinformation is extraordinary. And so this, in a sense, Max Hastings' definition of war with Russia has already started. So that's why I asked you that question, Jim, because I think that it is very serious. And I wasn't being flippant when I asked you, should we talk about World War III? Although I am certainly hopeful that that will turn out to have been the wrong question to ask, obviously. I mean, that goes without saying. But I do think that this is an incredibly serious, grim situation that we're in.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't disagree, which I couldn't, because when I woke up Sunday morning to, well, late Saturday night, saw the stories emanating from Israel, deeply disturbing. And it did certainly feel like one of these sort of pivotal moments in history. And I have, in recent years, read a lot of the stuff about the run-up to the beginning of World War II from historians like Max Hastings, Frank McDonough, and so on. And certainly there's a huge level of resonance around the place at the moment. And when you throw in players like Putin, Netanyahu, Trump, indeed, into the mix, you just get a sense of just how bloody dangerous the world is at the moment.
And I think there's one other important point to be made, precisely following on from your remarks there, Jim, is that although we might not be experts who is in predicting what might happen next, I think you can make some broad brush remarks. And I think that we can all say we hope that it doesn't result in a geopolitical catastrophe, but and that things eventually will get better. But I think that getting from here to there is actually going to take an awful long time, because whichever one of these geopolitical events that we look at, it's impossible for the experts, let alone the amateurs, to say how this could actually be resolved to some sort of better, more stable equilibrium. If the fighting in Gaza stopped tomorrow, that's by no means the end of it, because Gaza has been flattened and it is now a breeding ground for actual disease, for further terrorism, for God knows what. That situation is going to be unstable, whatever happens next, for a long period of time.
It's going to radicalize a whole new generation. Yeah.
So you cannot see that situation stabilizing quickly. We cannot see the situation in Ukraine stabilizing quickly. We could imagine more easily imagine a situation in Ukraine that we talk about this for years to come. Even if this front line stabilizes, the fighting will continue and the threats will continue. If the front line collapses and Russia takes Ukraine, we know that that is by no means the end of it, that Putin will go for Moldova, he will go for the Baltics, he will threaten Poland. So that situation, it's much easier to describe it lasting for years than it is to see it being resolved in some kind of peaceful, stable way. The lack of resolve shown by the West is said by the experts to be encouraging Xi Jinping to be looking fondly at Taiwan, and that if Putin gets Ukraine in particular, that people think that that will be the signal to Xi Jinping that we're not a serious people and that he can do what he likes. And similar messages will be taken by Kim Jong-un, who, again, I have read in some quarters by people that purport to know about these things, is said to be thinking about restarting the Korean War. Now, all of these things are bad enough in and of themselves. Put them together, and that's why I send you the text like that I sent you. So I think that this is something that is just going to rumble away for a very, very long time. Could get a lot better, a lot worse before it gets better. I hope not. But I certainly hope, like everybody else, that it gets a lot better. But we're going to be in this for a long period of time, which incidentally, given where we started this conversation, is why I think the markets were wrong to greet it. The news with relative insouciance, with a bit of a yawn in financial market terms. It seems crass to be talking about it in these terms, but I think that the impact for markets is for me, in my world, in my analysis, unambiguously negative. And sooner or later, probably sooner, the market is going to realize just how bad this is going to be for how long.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because gold today is trading at the record high of $2,350 per ounce. I think that's the highest. It is the highest level that gold has ever reached. So that's your classic flight to quality in an uncertain environment. But yet at the same time, equity markets are up today. Yeah, not up dramatically, but they are in positive territory. Brent crude is down over $1 on the day, which does tend to fly in the face of logic as well. The dollar is strong. I guess there's an economic story, which we'll get onto in a second, about that. Bond yields are up everywhere, which is an indicator of stronger growth, I would have thought. So there's a whole load of contradictions going on here in markets at the moment. And I'd be inclined to your view that this early market reaction is probably the wrong one. And given the nature of different asset classes and the way they're performing, you know, with oil prices down, with bond yields up, and equity markets up, and gold, as I say, at record highs, you'd have to think that the market is totally muddled, hasn't a bloody clue at the moment.
And Jim, talking about being totally muddled, can I ask you how your little investment portfolio is doing?
Yeah, 191.50.
Okay.
It's absolutely mad.
For readers that don't know, Jim went in at 200.
Went in at 198 actually, because two went on commission. But
we're talking about Bitcoin for those listeners that are new to this.
It's been up at 215. It's been down at 185. And the level of volatility is extraordinary. And actually, what really strikes me about this little experiment for mine is that I've been trying to observe the factors that are driving this volatility, and I can find no correlation to anything other than a crowd of geeks out there somewhere trading this stuff. There's no fundamental basis for it, and despite the fact that I've dipped my toe in very, very modestly, I remain deeply skeptical about it as an asset class. And when you get this sort of volatility without any real fundamental factor driving it, you'd have to say, you know, this is very, very dangerous for innocent investors, if you want to put it that way. But it is an amazing market story. And I think you're right. I think this initial market reaction to the weekend's events is definitely the wrong one. And okay, that there is a sort of a sense of relief that Israel hasn't retaliated, but it could take a couple of weeks for that retaliation to be put in place as such.
And I think the market is saying that the retaliation could well be just against one of Iran's proxies rather than Iran itself, and that Iran will not react after that, or some permutation or combination of events like that. I certainly hope that we don't see any retaliation for all our sakes, because as I say, that's another step on the road to outright war. Jim, I've got a question for you, which is on the same theme, but moving on from burbling on about the Middle East situation. But I want to focus on one event that is rumored to be partly a result of what happened over the weekend, is that the Americans, in the form of the Speaker, Mike Johnson, might be voting on, finally, the aid to Ukraine this week. It's only an if, but, and a maybe, but we might be close to a vote. I happened to decide to research, via Wikipedia, that well-known research tool, Speaker Mike Johnson. I don't know how much you know about that man, Jim, but the fate of Ukraine is in his hands. I mean, I think you'd probably agree with that.
It certainly is.
Did you know that he was a creationist?
Yeah.
I didn't. That was a complete surprise to me.
I did actually, Chris, and
He believes the Earth is 6,000 years old.
Yeah. I'm hesitant to say about Johnson what I really feel about him, because I'm not sure can one be sued for defamation. But
I think we should restrict ourselves to facts at the moment, because the facts are jaw-dropping enough
Everything I know about the guy would suggest to me that it is frightening that the future of Ukraine is in the hands of an individual like this. It is absolutely frightening.
Yes, and it's extraordinary. We've remarked in different ways before, during all the great Brexit shenanigans, we talked about that if you saw one of these people and were able to identify one of their beliefs, you could identify all 28 of their beliefs.
Yes, yeah.
And I've told you that he's a creationist. I've told you that he believes the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And so you could certainly, and I know you know, but if you didn't know, you could tell me what he thinks of abortion, what he thinks about gay marriage, what he thinks about LGBT people, that he's an absolute Christian fundamentalist evangelical type person. He belongs to the hard right conservative groups all over the place. But like a lot of these people, he was originally, back in the day, very anti-Trump.
Yeah.
And, a bit like J.D. Vance, he's worked out which side his bread is buttered and has had, shall we say, appalling Damascene conversion to the Trump cause, if I can use that metaphor. So a very sinister individual, I think. And if the fate of Ukraine is in the hands of that one man, God help us all,
I couldn't agree more with you, Chris, to be honest. I had a very bad weekend, actually. QPR lost 3-0 away to Hull on Saturday, which was disastrous. La Rochelle were hammered by Leinster.
What do you mean, La Rochelle? I thought you're a Leinster man, aren't you?
I am on my back. Even the sheep in Waterford shout for La Rochelle at the weekend. So, but anyway, Chris, I had a very bad weekend. Arsenal, of course, lost yesterday. So a bad weekend on the sporting front overall. And then today we get the US retail sales data.
We're back to our trifecta of disagreements.
We are indeed. And very definitely the odds are moving in your favour. I would stress it is April, but retail sales in March up 0.7% month on month, which was much stronger than expected. 8 of the 13 categories expanded. And the February increase was revised up to plus 0.9. So the US economic story is just strengthening again. And that is being reflected in the performance of the dollar, which is at 106.40. We spoke about it last week. We were saying that parity could easily be seen, and it was over 108 at that stage. So that's moving in our direction. But in terms of the US economy and the Federal Reserve stance on interest rates, certainly everything that's happening at the moment would, I think, prevent many sensible Fed officials from voting for a rate cut anytime soon. So you're winning this one, Chris. I'll hand you that.
But I stress there's a lot of early days. It's early days.
Yeah, Chris, the final discussion I'd like to have with you today is around economic forecasting. And Ben Bernanke, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve during the crash back in 2007, 2008, and I think generally did a pretty decent job in managing the Federal Reserve through that crisis. But he was commissioned to undertake a study of the forecasting performance and policy record of the Bank of England. And his report was published last week. He said that there was significant shortcomings which contributed to its failure to foresee the surge in inflation. He said that the Bank of England has invested heavily in outdated software. It needs to replace or thoroughly revamp its economic model, which is called Compass. And you'd know a lot more about that than I would, given your background. He said that the fan charts have outlived their uselessness. And fan charts, I have to say, since the Bank of England started using fan charts, the Monetary Policy Committee, they really do go over my head. But there are charts which show...
Well, don't be too hard on yourself, Jim. The reason why they go over all of our heads is that they're meaningless.
They're meaningless, absolutely. Probability of different outcomes. You know, it's mad sort of stuff. So it was a pretty brutal verdict that Bernanke provided about the Bank of England's performance. But he did also say that basically the Bank of England was no worse than every other central bank.
That's the rub.
Forecasters, yeah.
That was Bernanke's way of saying this, that I think you could be a lot more sophisticated about this. You could have better, more experienced people. He wasn't damning about the people. He was just saying that they're all too junior, that the only way to make career progress in the Bank of England is to move on from the forecasting division. He talked, as you say, about their software, their data management capabilities. I was surprised to see just how poor they are at data. He basically described a bunch of youngsters moving numbers from one spreadsheet to another as part of the forecasting exercise. That was just jaw-dropping from a practitioner point of view. And his point, of course, about it being no worse than anybody else's, had a real sting in the tail that he couldn't possibly go all the way, push the logic all the way, because if he did, he'd have reached the same thing, the same conclusion that you and I have talked about so many times over the last number of years on this podcast, Jim, was that you can do this in a very sophisticated way, or you can do it in a very cack-handed way like the Bank of England does, but you're going to end up in the same place, which is a bunch of forecasts that are going to be wrong.
Yeah.
And that's your problem. And that's, I think, the elephant in the room that he didn't address, which is that this is something that you can't do. I tell you, you talked about my background. I was an economic forecaster way back in the early 1980s. I ran the economic forecasting for an outfit called the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. And that's the British equivalent of the ESRI. And I ran their model and did all that data handling thing that Bernanke was talking about the Bank of England do. And do you know the extraordinary thing? I mean, over 40 years ago, all of the things Bernanke talked about were just all the things that I used to do. I and my little team used to do at the National Institute 40 years. And it doesn't seem that anything has changed. That's the extraordinary thing. And I think there's actually a good reason for this, because I don't think things could have changed, because it's the ultimate sausage machine. you really don't want to see how your sausages are made, because if you do, you'll be turned right off them. And economic forecasting is the ultimate sausage factory. That we simply do not have the tools and techniques. So whether or not Bernanke's reforms lead to better policy making, I think is a very open question, because the Bank of England made mistakes. He is implicitly saying that some of those mistakes were made because of the cack-handed way they do forecasts. But I think he's also saying that some of those mistakes would have been made anyway, even if they'd had the most sophisticated forecasting mechanism in the world. Because I'll bet you, if he did that review of the ECB, or indeed at his alma mater, the Federal Reserve, I wonder if the conclusions would have been that much different.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Chris, great talking again. I have got a lot of very positive feedback from people around the place about your podcast with Edgar Morgenroth.
Well, that's nice to hear.
And I'm taking it all very personally because...
well, don't, because we are going to do it again with Edgar.
I was obviously not involved in. Listen, our next podcast, which we're going to record on Wednesday, just a precursor, we are talking to a guy who's a friend of mine, David Higgins, who is a young economist, a young political strategist. He did Trojan work during COVID on statistical analysis of COVID numbers and all that. So anyway, he's agreed to give us a half an hour on Wednesday just to talk about the political situation here, because we've said numerous times that we really should give as much coverage as possible to Irish politics over the coming months, because it's, you know, going to fundamentally impact on all our lives in this country. So I look forward to having David with us on Wednesday. So listen, good to talk, and mind yourself.
Take it easy, Jim. Looking forward to that chat with David. That's great.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.